From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
Coming up, it's the anniversary of the Chevron refinery fire in Richmond. We'll hear from a nonagenarian who took her environmental frustrations to a new level.
I was sitting there with those handcuffs on. I couldn't have been smiling more because I was so pleased. I did it.
Then we'll debate how to maintain a not-so-old-growth forest.
A lot of people walk out here and they see green and they think, wow, green. The area is healthy. It's lush. But there's good green and there's bad green.
And we visit a home in Visitation Valley that's making things easier for people with HIV and AIDS.
Because we only pay one-third of our income for rent, we can afford to have a better life.
Humans and their habitats, today on Cross Currents. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the Chevron refinery fire in Richmond. The fire, caused by a leak in a 40-year-old pipe, sent a plume of smoke across nearby neighborhoods, leading thousands of residents to eventually seek medical care. Government investigations found that Chevron did not replace the pipe, despite the warnings of its own inspectors, and it could have avoided the fire if it shut the plant down sooner. The corporation yesterday promised greater safety efforts and agreed to pay $2 million in fines. For some perspective, Chevron makes that much money every 40 minutes. This past Saturday, over 1,000 protesters marched to the gates of Richmond's Chevron refinery to speak out. Some protesters focused on the company's track record, while others looked at the bigger picture of the oil industry's role in climate change. One organization that hosted the event was 350.org, led by Bill McKibben. Hundreds of people were arrested, including 90-year-old Ellen Small, who was inspired by McKibben's speeches, encouraging older activists to commit acts of civil disobedience. It was the first time she'd ever been arrested. KALW's Daniel Moore went to Ellen's house to ask why she chose to get arrested now, after all this time.
I thought it was a thrilling experience. I really, truly did.
What was thrilling for you?
Well, the main thing that was thrilling about it for me was I finally was really doing something. And that's one of the frustrations in life, when you want to do things and you can't do them, and especially in things like helping with the environment. I don't know. I mean, I always feel so sort of helpless. But this time I really felt as though I was doing something, and it was exciting.
Do you feel like you accomplished your aim?
Yes, indeed, because I think the fact that somebody of my age was there, it did make a difference in the pictures that were taken and the pictures that were used. So I think that the fact that this old girl was out there did help.
And tell me, what was your goal going into the protest?
Well, my goal, I really hoped to be arrested because that was something I thought would give my presence a little extra jazz.
Do you remember a defining moment when you decided to protest this past Saturday?
Well, I decided to see if I could get arrested. And, of course, it goes back to Bill McKibben talking about demonstrations. And he suggested that it was a much better idea for the older people to get arrested than for the younger people to get arrested, because what do we have to lose? And so I thought that was, he was speaking to me, definitely. So I was delighted to be able to be there.
What was it like to be arrested?
Well, it happened very fast. It really did. And I must say, to me, they could not have been nicer.
Do you think that they treated you differently because you were 90?
They might have. I know when, as soon as I was arrested with, and say, the handcuffs on me, I was escorted to a bench, sat down, and they took the handcuffs off. Although I must say, I was sitting there with those handcuffs on. I couldn't have been smiling more because I was so pleased. I did it. I will say this, though. When we were lined up in the rows in front of the gate, and that lineup of the coppers, you know, standing, you know, like this, and they were standing there with their, you know, their arms, I think, together, and it looked to me as though they had gas masks on, and They really looked rather scary. And I know that they were doing, that's what they're supposed to be. They weren't supposed to be there beckoning. They were supposed to look like a solid force. And I'm glad I wasn't asked to tackle one of them because they were mighty big men and they looked very strong and a bit scary. But they were doing their job. That's what they were there for. And say once I got through the gate, they could not have been nicer.
What do you think of the people in the oil business?
Well, the people in the oil business, they're not bad people, but they are misguided. And I think we've all got to get into this climate business together. Oil people have got to see that what they're doing is not right. And they've got great skills. And I think they've got to get in and really find new ways to provide energy. And they mean well, but they are so misguided. And no, some of my best friends are in the oil business, and it's very sad to me because they're brilliant people and very, very capable. And I think the climate business is such we've got to treat it as if we were going to war. I mean, we got together quickly in World War II, and you know, the whole country got behind it. And I think somehow, some way, and I suppose it's going to be some disaster that'll bring it on, but we've got to get together, all of us, big corporations, the little people, everybody's got to get into it because we're all here on the earth together. And it's going to take all of us working together to combat the terrible climate problem that we've got.
What about your future? Are you going to go to more protests?
If there's some that I can help you, I certainly will. I certainly will. And I think I will tell you one thing. Sitting on that concrete sidewalk or whatever it was, I thought I was amply cushioned, but it's rather hard. Also, I'm going to have to practice getting up off the ground. I'm not as nimble as I used to be, but say getting up and sitting down is a little hard when you're 90, but I did it, and I can do it again. You know, if I can be of any help, I certainly will do it.
That's 90-year-old Ellen Small, who was arrested for the first time ever outside the Chevron refinery on Saturday. She spoke with KALW's Daniel Moore. Have you ever been arrested for activism? What was your experience like? Let us know on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Just under 22 years ago, back in October of 1991, a fire caught in the Oakland Hills. That fire killed 25 people and destroyed more than 3,000 homes. It was so destructive in part because of the many eucalyptus trees found throughout the Oakland Hills. Eucalyptus are highly flammable. When ignited, they can explode. They're such a hazard, federal emergency officials may remove tens of thousands of them in the East Bay, an idea that rankles many who hike in those forests. There's a similar controversy in the middle of San Francisco amongst the eucalyptus trees on Mount Sutro. UCSF, which owns the land, has a plan to thin some areas. The Sutro stewards, who help maintain the forest, support the plan. But another group with a similar name, Save Sutro, formed specifically to oppose it. KALW's Ray Sue Sussman has the story.
It's a rare sunny morning on Mount Sutro, and I'm hiking up with Rupa Bose. Bose lives in the Forest Knolls neighborhood, just down the hill, and she only discovered the forest a few years ago.
It was a shock to me that you could come out of a very ordinary San Francisco neighborhood full of houses and cars and step into this forest, and it was birds and the wind in the trees, and it doesn't feel like being in the city at all. So, yeah, it's simply gorgeous.
Bose now hikes here a few times a week, and she's a member of Save Sutro.
I'm sorry it's not a foggy day, because you should see this place when it's acting like a cloud forest. There's an understory of various plants, but I would say that blackberry predominates. There are some vines climbing up the trees. I don't see any of them having reached into the canopy. They're just climbing the trunks. And I have heard that unlike kudzu, which climbs into the canopy, climbs out onto the branches and strangles the trees, these ivies don't do that. They just climb the trunks and then stay put.
Later that week, I go on another hike up on Mount Sutro. This time, I'm with Craig Dawson. He grew up right below the forest, also in the Forest Knolls neighborhood. He loves it up here, has for half a century, and now he coordinates the trail maintenance and planting for the Sutro Stewards. He looks at the forest differently than Bose, starting with the ivy.
So the English ivy is one of the largest problems that we have out here. The English ivy will climb into the crowns of the trees, and it actually kills the tree that it's climbing eventually. Not instantly, but over a period of years. A lot of people walk out here and they see green and they think, wow, green. The area is healthy. It's lush. But there's good green and there's bad green. And when you want to evaluate a forest and you want to talk about management, you have to take a look at what is actually beneficial and what is actually harmful. We were just talking about the ivy climbing into the trees. That's harmful. We have two types of ivy. We have Cape ivy, which is the light green stuff down here. And we have the English ivy, which is way up in the tops of some trees.
Two hikes, two conversations with people who love this place, yet two very different perspectives on where it's at now. To understand the forest, we need to look at its roots. How did it even come to be here in the middle of the city? In the 1860s and 70s, a German immigrant named Adolf Sutro made millions in Nevada's Comstock Lode silver mine. He came to San Francisco and invested in real estate. A lot of real estate. Sutro eventually owned 1/12 of San Francisco, including what was then called Blue Mountain. Sutro called it Mount Parnassus, and it is now known as Mount Sutro. To celebrate San Francisco's very first Arbor Day in 1886, Sutro planted thousands of trees on his extensive property, mainly blue gum eucalyptus. And before he died at the turn of the century, Sutro gave some of his land on top of Blue Mountain to UCSF. The land hosted a lumber mill. Ishii lived there. The military had part of its Nike missile defense system up there. But from the late 1970s through the late 90s, the forest was pretty much left alone.
We have owls. There's a couple different types. We have the hawks that are up here. And you can witness that quite frequently along these trails where you'll see the signs of something having been recently devoured. We have coyotes sighted up here regularly. We have the raccoons and skunks and possum. Years ago, we used to have red-tailed fox up here.
Craig Dawson tells me there was even a mountain lion spotted a few years ago, so it's pretty wild for an urban forest. But the unchecked growth could keep it from being
a healthy forest, a safe forest, a beautiful forest, and an accessible forest.
That's Barbara Baggett-Lopez, the Director of Community Relations for UCSF. The university has a forest management plan, originally developed in the late 90s after a community feedback process, but the draft environmental impact report for the plan only came out last year, and after more community discussions, it's still not slated to start until next summer.
We're going to work to thin the trees and to remove underbrush. So it's a more open understory. You can say, stand back, neighbors, UCSF, experts, whoever, can stand back and say, do I like that or do I not like it?
Rupa Bose of Save Sutro does not like it.
Talking about removing 90% of the understory, mowing down 90% of the understory in the demonstration areas.
Bose's estimate is based on the most severe scenarios in the draft environmental impact report. And Sutro Stewards Craig Dawson?
That will never happen. It's just not a possibility.
Whether it's a lot of cutting or a little, UCSF's Barbara Baggett-Lopez says,
we'll have to see how how people react to it. The other thing about visual effects, and it really isn't something you can see immediately, but when you enable trees to thrive, then their canopies open up more, and you can kind of look around Mount Sutro and see, boy, that's a scrawny tree. That's one that's pretty scrawny too. But if they have room to breathe and room to actually make use of the nutrients in the soil, the canopies end up filling out. So it's much, much more fuller and much healthier looking.
Managing an urban space isn't easy. The more people who use it, the more opinions there are on what should be done with it, and the longer it can take to actually implement a plan. But whether they like it or not, the regular hikers on Mount Sutro will see a different forest sometime next year, probably. On Mount Sutro, I'm Resu Sussman for Cross Currents.
So does a small urban forest need management the same way streets and sewers and buildings need maintenance? What do you think? Let us know on our Facebook page. We are KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Whether it's maintaining a forest or helping a 90-year-old activist off the sidewalk, sometimes a little help goes a long way. And that's the main philosophy behind the Leland House in San Francisco's Visitation Valley. The residential care facility has been assisting people living with HIV and AIDS since it opened 16 years ago. The house gives low-income patients an affordable place to live, which helps offset the costs of expensive medications by a lot. The cost of medication an HIV patient has to take can reach nearly $30,000 per year. And when you consider the median rent for a one-bedroom apartment in the city is almost $2,800, you start to see how helpful Leland House really is to the patients it serves. KALW student reporter Megan Quintana has always known about Leland House because her mom is a nursing assistant there. But she'd never visited for that long, and she wanted to know more about what it was like. So she took her recorder and brings us this story of what makes Leland House a special place.
My mom's worked at Leland House for 12 years, sometimes coming home with news stories about her second family. Because the people living there were really sick, I always imagined it to be a very restricted and highly supervised place for them. I wanted to know more, so my mom took me on a tour.
Okay. Hello.
Hi, Nikki Dyer?
Yeah.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
You look exactly alike.
The first thing I noticed is that everyone is casual and seemed close.
Maria.
Yeah.
I told you what I call you.
It's like they're a home, because most of the people, they've been there for a long time. Like, you always see them every day. So it's like the family. It's a family.
Leland House is run by Catholic Charities, a social service of the Catholic Church that works to end poverty in the Bay Area. Leland House recruits its clients directly from hospitals and straight off the streets. The most basic requirements to move into Leland? People need to have disabling HIV or AIDS.
It's given me a stable house.
This is Alan Turpin. He's lived with HIV for 33 years and is one of the residents here at Leland House. We sit down to talk in the nursing office.
I did become sick. I was living in a house that I couldn't get up the stairs, as I have a degenerative disc disorder, and the discs are collapsing in my back. So the old house where I used to live was in Noy Valley, and I can't get up the stairs any longer. So I was able to obtain housing here.
Because of Leland House, Turpin can still afford to live in the city he loves.
Because we only pay one-third of our income for rent, we can afford to have a better life.
I was surprised to find that many of the residents still have a lot of control over their lives. Even though Turpin is sick, he can still do a lot of things he enjoys.
It's an independent housing facility, and so actually there's no structure. You can do what you want during the day, but I get up in the morning and I need to take my pills for my HIV, and then I'll eat breakfast, and I'll watch some TV, and I'm in college online, so I take online courses, and so I do some homework. I can do that throughout the day, and I need to spend like 4 to 6 hours on the computer.
Most of them, they're very independent, so like they can do whatever they want. You have to do is monitor them. If they're kind of sick, you know, you have to take their kind vital sign, making sure that they're okay.
Like Turpin, everyone here has a routine. One of the only big rules is that dinner is always at 5 p.m. sharp. I go to the cafeteria around 5 and sit down with some residents. It looks like my high school's cafeteria, with multiple round tables scattered around the room, and most of the tables filled. There's an opening in the wall with a nurse inside serving dinner to residents who are patiently lined up. I was surprised when some of them decided on no dinner. Even with lots of freedom and the illnesses the residents have, being at Leland House can be difficult.
Well, sometimes they have a psychological problem. And some people sometimes they're on drugs, all kind of drugs. So they're dealing of crack, speed, and heroin. Now it's not really hard anymore. I used to it already, so it's easy for me now. Especially it's like my family, because every single day I work with them. Like I spend more hours, like 8 hours with them than I spend in my house with my family.
Visiting Leland House gave me a whole new perspective on what life is like there. Not only did I see a lot of freedom given to the residents, but I saw closeness that everyone shared. Now I know what my mom means when she calls the people at Leland House her second family. For Cross Currents, I'm Megan Quintana.
Megan Quintana is a rising senior at Burton High School in San Francisco, where KALW is based. She was a summer reporting intern with us this year. For today's edition of Cross Currents, the team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Tiffany Kamhai, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Leah Rose, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. And before we go, we'd like to acknowledge the life of pioneering arts advocate Ruth Asawa, who passed away last night. Asawa was known for her wire sculptures and activism in arts education. Her public sculptures include the Mermaid Fountain at Ghirardelli Square, the Hyatt Fountain on Union Square, and the Japanese American Internment Memorial in San Jose. Asawa was passionate about arts and public education and started San Francisco's first public school of the arts in 1982, which was later named after her in 2010. Rest in peace, Ruth Asawa. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.